The lament, really, of every parent, child, a teacher, prophet, and God had his troubles too. It is this: you have ears, but you do not hear. And the lament of every student is, they don't listen to me. And this, of course, has been probably a concern to you. It's been a great concern to me as I give sterling lectures to the students, and then I test them. And there seems to be little relationship with what I told them and what they tell me that I told them. And you can get in a lot of trouble by not listening. I think this is well exemplified by a little story, perhaps I've told it here before, about a neighbor we had, Janet Wood. She was the only girl in the family. There were two older brothers. And Janet was very beautiful. I mean, physically and also within her. She had an inner beauty. Now, and one of the beautiful things about it is she didn't know herself how pretty she was. And the mother kept a very tight rein on her. I know some of you youngsters don't understand that now, but in those days they did. And she had gone to a Lutheran high school. And but Janet says, well, now, you know, I should get away from home to go off to college. And her mother had some misgivings about this, but she agreed to this. And it was a long ways away. It was over in the Midwest somewhere. And that's a long ways from here. And and it came to be September, and so the mother says, now, there's a few things that I must tell you, Janet, before you go there. Now, when you get to this college, and there's going to be probably quite a few boys who will, you know, ask you out on dates. And as the fall wears on, perhaps, some of them will become very fond of you. Perhaps one especially will become very fond of you, and you of him. And probably one evening, he will probably take you out in his car. There'll be a full moon, and he'll park the car, and he'll put his arm around you. And at that point, that's when your mother will start worrying. And with this, she sent her off. And so far away that she didn't come home for Thanksgiving, but she came home for Christmas. And and of course, you know, it's always a happy time. I've gone through this now for many times, having the kids come back at Christmas. It was really great. Well, it was great for Janet and great for her parents. And she hadn't been home very long, and she and her mother in the kitchen, and her mother said, well, you know, how'd things go, you know? Janet says, well, you know, it's just like you said, Mother. You know, fall wore on, and I became very fond of this boy after many dates. And it's like you said, one night, you know, the moon was full and went out, and parked the car, turned off the key, and put his arm around you. And I remembered what you said. So she said, what'd you do? Well, she says, I took his arm from around my neck, and I put my arm around his, and also I said, let your mother worry about you. Well, that isn't really what the mother was trying to get to, you know. I often ask, at this point, I give something like this to several groups, among them the professional students at orientation at the university. And I modify this depending on the situation, but there are some students here, so I'll try to adapt it. Some of you are in business. But there is more concern about this now than it used to be. In Nichols, when he made a survey back in the early 50s, he found that only one college that he could really dig up taught anything about listening comprehension. And that was Stevens College. It was taught as one of the social graces. I know a few of these girls, and they really did quite well with it. And he also surveyed papers at that time, you know, in research papers in the communication journals. And of 3,000 papers that he thought were really quite good on communication, all but one was on reading. There was only one on listening comprehension, and this was in the early 50s. Since that time, of course, this has been entered into the curriculum in many places. It's being taught in the army, in business. There are courses in listening comprehension. Perhaps some of you in business have utilized some of these courses. For a price you can get them, and you really do see an improvement in listening comprehension with these courses. And people are becoming very concerned about these. My son knows I'm sort of uptight on this, and when he was in his psychiatric clerkship, he attended the meeting, the national meeting that happened to be in Seattle, where he was working, and he was with this opportunity to attend the American psychiatric meetings there. And they had a proposal, and they said, unless we devise a new spirit of listening to each other, we will in the United States of America have years of hideous, hateful struggles between peoples, generations, racial groups. There will be no real winners. Between the United States of America and other nations of the world, anger, disappointment will prevail, and maybe we'll blow up the world or strangle it with poison. Peace between nations must be preceded by a much more effective mode of communication between all peoples within nations. Effective understanding and the ability to communicate is more important today than ever before. And the number one mistake in the world today is the hope that someone else somewhere is fixing things up. And they then made some concrete proposals. And I'll only give you one of them. But the world psychiatric profession, abandoning the delusion that it is up to someone else, somewhere else, to fix things up, asks that many of its members plan a personal venture in his own community designed to enhance awareness of alternatives to deafness, prejudice, and violence, designed to stimulate communication and understanding as alternatives to hatred and suspicion. Now, how do we spend our day? And there have been several analyses on this. Rankin of Ohio some years ago logged the activity of 60 people for several months. We did this when I was with General Electric Company. Periodically we'd make a time analysis. And it's very revealing if you do this on yourself, on just how you waste your time. And it's very revealing, and I commend it to you that you sort of analyze each given day on what you do with your time. Now, in this particular group, and he had the cooperation of these people, first of all, I should point out that, you know, over 90% of what you learn through your eyes and ears. But within this group, you realize that 70% of their day was spent in communication, some aspect of it. Now, for some of you, it's more than that. For the students, it's more than that. But of the 70%, then, of the communication of the day, this was broken then down into 9% of it was spent in writing, 16% in reading, 30% in speaking, and 45% in listening. Yet if you examine now, they're training for this. Some of these people, and I, you know, we employ them in the laboratory where I work. I mean, some of these people come to me with probably, you know, 8 or 10 years of college, probably. And they've spent maybe 16 years writing or learning how to write and learning how to read. I must admit some of them yet don't know how. But they've spent a lot of time in formal training for this. They have also now learned, had some teaching in making speeches, in the communication from the standpoint of oral presentation. We do a lot better with that than when I went to school. When I went to school, only the preacher's son and I think the lawyer's son would, you know, take something in speech. I was neither. I mean, you probably figure that out. Right? But in listening, there was no courses. You know, this is something you're supposed to, you know, I guess you're born with it. You're supposed to learn how to listen. After all, you've got 2 ears and some of us got real big ones. So this should make it possible. Well, it really doesn't. And in Columbia, Harvey Jones made a study of 486 freshmen in psychology. there. And that was at a time when Columbia attracted rather good students. And he was very disheartened because he thought they were giving very good lectures, and then he would test them. And he found out that in what he considered very good testing, and this is always a problem, if he gave a test right after these lectures, there was only really a 50% recall of what was given that he thought was important. And he waited a couple of months, and he only had a 25% retention. Now Nichols, in his review of this, he said, "Boy, this is awful. This is awful. They can't be this bad in Minnesota." So at the University of Minnesota, he did about the same thing, and he employed some of the outstanding communicators within his course. He said, "Now I want you to give the thing you like best. Summarize it, say, in 10 minutes, you know, and give them, you know, right down the line, and then, you know, we're going to test them on it." And he obtained essentially the same result, but he only waited 2 weeks before he gave the second test and found out, you know, about 25%. He said, "If I had waited only 2 days, I'd have probably gotten the same result." Now, if you only have about a 25% retention of what you're telling people, you're in trouble. And we are in trouble. In business, and I can give you many illustrations. I'll see how the time goes. I might go to some of this. I will give you an example of this. There was a fellow who came, I think, to Nichols and said, "Well, I want to do something." Maybe he'd heard him and said, "I want to do something in listening." So he sent him down to a fellow in Louisiana who he thought was interested in this too. And he said, "You go on down there and study under this professor." And this professor says, "Now, I'll tell you what I want you to do first. I'll line you up with some of the leading companies in this town. And here, I want you to make some notes as you go into them, and ask him about how the business is running, what kind of communication you have with your employees, what is the attitude of the employees to your business, what is the morale of the employees, and this type of thing." So this is what he did, you know, rather uniformly. You know, we feel we have the best means of communication. We really relate to the employees. I mean, we have good relations with them. They understand the mission of the organization. They respond well to us. We listen to their complaints, and we take care of them, and the morale is high. And this was sort of a general response as viewed by the managers. And so he came back and reported this to his professor. He said, "Right now, for the next year, here's a stack of notebooks. And I want you to put on your overalls. You go down and you're going to move from one company to the other. I made these arrangements. You're going to be assistant truck driver. And you're going to communicate with these employees at various levels and find out what they think of the company." And rather uniformly, they made vicious attacks on management. "They don't listen to us. I don't know what they're really trying to get at. We don't know what's going on, you know." And it was just really malicious. So there was a failure there. And I know within the General Electric Company, for example, in attitude surveys, we see this. When you go from the vice president, for example, or the chairman of the board, and as you go down to the man on the line, boy, there's an awful lot lost. There isn't so much if it's like foreman to foreman. I mean, there's really pretty good communication. They understand one another. Even if they don't say the right thing, you have a feel for it. It's just like, you know, your wife and yourself. You say, if you really know them, you know, you don't even have to say it sometimes. You understand what the problem is. But boy, when you're going from down to up or up to down, you're in trouble. Well, now Nichols is very disturbed about this, and he says, "Well, you know," he consulted some shrinks and psychiatrist and psychologist and you know, a lot of tests, and he said, "Now let's find out what characterizes the good and the bad listener." And what they did, of course, some people had, you know, had good, or some of them were good listeners, and they'd come down with a good response. They had tight test grades. Others were lousy, you see. So what they did was find out, why were they lousy? What are the characteristics of the bad listener? And he did. He made 9 or 10 things, which I'm going to tell you about now. Some of them may not apply to some of you, This is directed a lot at the student. Of course, the first thing is, you know, the bad listener. And this isn't one that they mentioned, but it's one I have noted. And this is one of the things I always point out to my class before I begin it, you know, at least large classes. That is, you know, you can't listen to me if you're talking to somebody else. So that's certainly, that's sort of the number one. If you're going to hear what the fellow said, you got to listen. At least sort of pay attention. But the first thing that happens, they noted, is you go to a lecture and you're dragged there, especially with a student. Maybe it's somewhere he doesn't want to be. So his first response is, that's an uninteresting subject. G.K. Chesterton, who is one of my favorite authors, and he was my favorite author, or one of my favorite authors, before I even knew that he loved pigs. Now, I should have given you something on this the other night. It's some beautiful things to say how pigs were beautiful, you know, their sleek lines and all. But I don't have time to give it to you now, but it was really great. And he said, there's no such a thing as an uninteresting subject, just uninterested listeners. And that's the way it is. And what you should do, even today, you know, like, you know, who wants to hear about this or other subjects? You know, who wants to hear that? Well, you should look at it. Now, maybe there's something in it for me. Maybe to all this this mess that this fellow is trying to put out here, maybe there's something that I can really use. And so you look at it that way. It's sort of a challenge to find something in it. The other thing, and it's usually done very early in the lectures, and especially in mine, and sometimes I gimmick this with my classes. I remember the first time I did this to this class, and it was a big class in a big auditorium. And this was in the days when string ties were the thing, you know, narrow ties. Well, I always keep my ties, and the chief doesn't like this. You know, I got a whole drawer full of them. Sometimes she throws some of them away. But, you know, they always come back into stock. Well, many years ago, we had what my son called belly warmers, you know. Well, belly warmers are back in now. They're very broad, you know. So, and I went in, I was to wear a lab coat. I came walking in, and it kind of slumped, my coat sort of fell open. And very obviously, you know, I had that big belly warmer tie on. And, you know, every student in the class, you know, he wouldn't be caught dead wearing a belly warmer tie. And you can take a look at me, too. You know, and they got a lot of material to work on, you know. You know, I'd like to have that nose full of nickels, you know. Look at the ears on that. I've never seen it since Clark Gable. Now, some of you don't remember that. Or, you know, Ben Franklin, boy, he looked better in those kind of glasses than that guy does. You know, and they're going along like this. And sometimes I do what I'm doing today, you know. And the other night I pulled this. But then you saw his belly wearing a tie, you know. You could just see him, you know. You know,
you know, someone writing notes, you know.
Or the other night to a ladies' group. They'd heard I talk about listening and maybe they're having trouble with their husbands or something. They wanted me to talk to them about listening. And I walked in and I sat down, and they didn't have a podium or anything, so I sat back on a chair. And it was very obvious. I had one blue sock on, one white sock on, you know. And it was like, what, orange? That's blue and that's orange, you know. That's how I tell right from left. And these women, you know, you just see them, you know. Right, and one of them wrote notes, passed it over, you know. Now, and I always point out, usually the best part of my lecture is the first paragraph, because that's the only one I prepared, you know. And while I'm giving this, they're criticizing the speaker, you know. You know, they haven't heard a thing because they're busy criticizing. A lot of students, I mean, they came down afterwards. And just, you know, that's what we were doing, you know. So, my speech, you know, it isn't always in English. I speak American, Western American, sort of. And you can criticize that. If somebody came in here today and says, get the heck out of here, this rat nest on fire, you know, you wouldn't say, couch that in better rhetoric, you know. You'd get out of here. Huh? You see, so here, try to hear what he has to say. Hear them out before you judge. Another thing I've noticed, this too, and Nichols noted this, the people become over-concerned with facts and detail instead of trying to get at the concepts being presented. And this is true in the professions. in the medical and the veterinary profession. You know, I read their journals, and they're always, for example, giving everything to four significant figures. Maybe at 6 cases out of 11, you know, and they give the percentage to 4 significant places. Absolutely ridiculous, you know, instead of saying, in general round number. And I get after them about this. In fact, boy, I really give them a bad time if they give it to me in more than 2 significant figures. And I remind them of this very important thing. That what are the most important figures relative to a biological entity? It's a woman's age. That's the most important. And that isn't significant beyond 2 significant figures. You men, do you care if they're 29 or 29.2? You don't. And this is true with many things. You look for the main ideas instead of getting jazzed up with the detail. Another thing, I pointed out to you students, I sort of used to do this myself, on taking notes, you know. You get so wound up, overzealous on taking, real neat notes. I know when I was over at the School of Medicine at the University of Washington, when I was doing graduate work there, and I was taking some of the classes with the medical students. There's one student, he'd taken his pre-med at Harvard, and he used a ruler. And every line was straight, you know, and really neat. The neatest notes gone. He didn't get an A in the course, though. I think he would have spent more time listening and really taking the facts down. He probably would have, because he's a pretty smart guy. He's in cancer research now and doing a good job, but he got too wound up with his outline. Another thing that the bad listener does, and I see some of these sometimes in the front row in school, and they fake attention. And some of us, when we're listening to somebody else and trying intently to do this, or trying to at least impress upon the person that we are really listening, you know, or you can sit them up there. They're like a racehorse, you know, before the gate opens, huh? You know, every muscle is tense. And you know, you're boy ready to take off, you know, just, you know, your ears are, you know, vibrating. Well, this takes effort. This takes a lot of effort that you can spend other ways. I mean, you can relax and still, you know, listen to this person. It takes a lot of effort to be an actor. I learned to be a ham in high school. It was a very small high school, and they were hard up for actors, and about everybody had to get in every play. And so I had to do this. And I had to try to be somebody else. And boy, that was hard work. And I'm reminded here, it's probably a story most of you have heard, but it's so apropos here, I think, that when you're trying to play a part that you're really not. And this story is told of a desperate man who came into this psychiatrist's office one night in quite a large city. And the psychiatrist listened to his story, and he was impressed with the depression that had overtaken this person. He was really touched by it. And he was seeking in some way to relieve the anxieties and to take this man's mind off his problems, which were very great. He was lower than a snake in a wagon track. Now that isn't what he wrote down as diagnosis, but you know what I mean. And then he remembered. He says, "I'll tell you what you do." He says, there's a great circus in town. And in the circus, there's really an outstanding clown. He says, "I want you to go down tonight and see this performance and see this clown, and he'll take your problems away. I mean, you'll really feel a lot better." And there was quite a long silence. And then the man said, "I am that clown." It's hard to be somebody else. It takes a lot of effort that isn't really worthwhile. Another thing that the bad listener does, he tolerates a bad performance. Now, the best thing that people do for me, and they've already done it since I come up here, is to say, "You know, you were really wrong there when you said that. Or you really give them the whole load of hay there when you shouldn't have. You know, you should have, you know, taken this out. Or in the classes I sit in, because we sort of team teach, at least in one course I'm involved in, and I sit up and listen to the performances of the other professors. And some of these are pretty lousy presentations. I can't see some of the material that's on the board, or on that is that are pictures that are slides or whatever they might use. Some of you can't even read it. You couldn't read it if you were halfway down in the auditorium. Or they speak so you can't hear them. Do the students say anything? Most of them don't. Now they're doing it more because I give them this lecture ahead of time, you know. So now they do it. Sometimes I can't stand it any longer. And I'll holler out, you know, I can't hear it, you know. Or I can't see it, you know. To try to get them going on it. Because this is the only way you're going to straighten them out. You know, if a person just comes up to me and says, well, great performance, you know, great performance. Well, sometimes it isn't, you know, best to just hit them over the head with it, you know. Says, well, you know, you can tell them, well, you know, there's some really good points there. But, you know, how about this, this, and this, you know. This is the only way you're going to make them improve. I mean, some of the best, some of my best friends are the ones that, you know, have given me the worst time sometimes, you know. Because they cared enough about me to correct me. And it wasn't easy to take a lot of times, you know. For about a day, you feel lower, really low and kind of down. Now, I sort of believe in the C.S. Lewis philosophy here. He says, a friend is no friend of mine if he doesn't care whether I lie, cheat, and steal.
And I tell my associates in my laboratory that, boy, you know, when I quit correcting you, you're in trouble. When I don't care about you anymore, you're in trouble. And that's why sometimes it's so hard on the children. You know? We don't want them to grow up to be clods. We correct them. And the thing you should do
here,
well,
you can use some diplomacy.
Another trait of the bad listener was that he took no interest in painstaking or technical listening. And they'd ask him, you know, what TV programs you listen to. You know, they always listen to the most inane things you can think of. You know, like Red Skelton or I Dream of Jeannie or Democratic National Convention. I mean, things, you know, you really didn't have to be there to listen to. It's really inane. And there are some good programs, they tell me. I've never watched TV, but there are some good programs where you really have to concentrate on what's going on. But the bad listener, in other words, this points out that, you know, if you're going to learn how to listen, you've got to work at it. You've got to really work at it. We let emotional words throw us.
Like the pill.
Sex.
Topless. Bottomless. Harry Truman. Spiro Agnew. I mean, you know, you can go along like this, you know. I mean, there are certain words that, you know, we're going along and we hear that word, you know, and then we quit listening and we start thinking about it, you know. We start thinking and we're carried away. We got to fight this. And the bad listener always did. I mean, the various these words would...
Lutherans do that when they hear somebody curse.
Yeah, that's right, you know. Boy, they wonder what the hang-up of that guy, you know. For me, you know, Christopher Columbus. Whenever I hear that, boy, I get, you know, by the way. Because I know Leif Erikson got there first 400 years before. And I have to figure out what I'm going to say to this guy. Another thing, the bad listener, he has mental lapses. Part of this because he has these mental... He has these emotional words that throw him, but for other reasons, you know, he goes along, and pretty soon he's way over there. We all do it. And part of it, the reason is because of this speaker. And I've run some experiments on this, where sometimes I give the lectures very rapidly. Now, I haven't been talking so fast today. I should have been probably speaking more rapidly. Most people, of course, speak at about this speed. And I have to go to... In my position, I've called on to go to many seminars and many lectures for candidates for positions for postdoctorals giving seminars, or pre-doctorals are giving seminars. And they get up there to give their seminar, and they give it at about their speed, I'm giving it now. And there's probably a good idea or a reasonable thing presented about every 5 minutes or so. And so in a period of about 50 minutes, there's probably two or three things that might be worth putting down. And I always bring a lot of work with me. In fact, I do a lot of my correspondence during this time. I turn them off for about 45 seconds, turn them back on. Now and then I'll jot down a question because I'm expected to ask some intelligent question at the end of the hour, just to prove that I was there and listening. But so we do contribute to this. And I think as time goes on, we'll be probably increasing the speed of our presentation, because the people here, for example, today, you would probably pay much closer attention, and you'd probably got a lot more out of the lecture if I went at about the speed I'm going now, which has come somewhere close to 200 words a minute. So we should probably speed up our presentation. Some of us can't think that fast, though, so we should give it. Now, we're gonna have a little discussion here in a moment, and then I'm going to take 5 minutes to conclude. But just before the discussion now, what are the qualities of good listening? I mean, how do you really listen well and you know, take down a point? Well, Herb has already told you probably the most important point. But Nichols says this. I don't know if these are the ones that are best for you, because I don't use the initial one here except just now and then. And sometimes it is helpful. But the good listener, first of all, he anticipates the next point. If there is some structure in the thing, it's kind of interesting to try to predict what this guy is going to say next. And thereby, you might learn by contrast, you see. Well, I wonder why he didn't do that. Now, why did he do this instead of this? So that might tend to fix it in your mind, you see. So you then learn by contrast and comparison. The other thing you do is you would try to identify the building blocks. You develop a structure. And this is what I tell them, at least in physiology, that there is a structure in all these systems, and I try to present to them the structure of how this organ works and its control mechanism. This is the important thing, and I try to give them a structure to work on. And once having established that structure, as you read or listen, and you reiterate that structure so you can plug in where there might be a change in the structure due to new findings or new evidence. And you have to kind of, at least in certain fields, you know, develop this kind of a attitude towards it. But the most important thing is the one that Herb has already mentioned, and that's mental recapitulation. Like today now, if you were really interested to, you know, to sort of get something out of this for yourself, or maybe tell somebody about it,
you should have been, as we went through, you see, and if you thought these points were legitimate, you should have gone through. Now, the last point was that.
You see, and as I was on number two, you might say, well, so the first one was this. And as I was going through, you should have been recapitulating what I said, so that by the time you've come down to number nine, you have reiterated or recapitulated these various ones, you see. And as you hear all of these lectures, if you listen to Herb, if you listen to Umhau, and as you listen to Willie on these points, or Larry, or Barbara, you know, all of these, you know, as you listen to them and try to practice this week now. As they go through and they make their point, you know, go back and try to fix them in your mind. And sometimes you learn by association, by maybe tying it to some crazy thing. And you remember it by associating with some crazy thing. And I'm going to stop now for a few minutes and then I'm going to give you another dimension to this. But I'd like some response now to this, or gimmicks that you have found that work. Now, part of this is tied, of course, to the teacher, and a lot of you know this. I mean, you've got to gimmick them.
I tell my students one thing. I hope I'm not going to give something that you were going to give.
No.
I tell my students the difference between a good student and a poor student is this. The poor student says, I hate this subject, I hate this teacher, I can't stand what's going on here, I wish I could be somewhere else. Now that's the poor student. The good student says, I hate this teacher, I hate this subject, I can't stand the way he's presenting it, I wish I were somewhere else, but I'm going to get this thing even if it kills me. This is one of the main they train yourself that they be on the subject.
Leo,
yes,
I use Nichols a lot, and I like some of the things he says. But the problem with both what you're saying and Nichols says is that you assume, or seem to be assuming, that most learning takes place by talking and listening. Teacher tell, student recall, teacher test. Whereas I think we've had plenty of evidence that people don't learn that way because of the 25%. You raise it to 30, you haven't changed much. That 30% recall from 25, that's progress, but it's not much. But doing and analyzing and experiencing and then generalizing and interpreting, you do that in your lab all the time. So it seems to me that Nichols and the way you're approaching this on the humanities level and the speaking teaching level, you're missing the very thing that you're doing with your rats. You're treating us worse than you're treating your rats.
I'll address this. What you say is generally true, and I haven't told you all the things I do, but we have about three problems here. It is true that in the lecture, I am generally opposed to the lecture system, because I have initiated at the University of California in a small sort of a way, and much of my teaching is in small group discussion, where the student has to present. The student has to present the material, we discuss it, he's challenged, and not great big presentations. He has to synthesize the material into just a few minutes. On a large subject, he has to synthesize it into maybe a 10 or 12 minute presentation. Or in the dialogue we use, we go around the room and people bring out the points and they're challenged. In professional teaching, in medicine, I think we're going to see a big revolution in this whole operation. Because we know that the best learning comes, or the really only productive thing as far as having made an impact on the medical student, maybe several years out in practice, is at work at a problem-solving situation, that he was in the problem-solving situation. Well, in a way, when you stand up to give a sermon or you make a presentation, the person that learned the most here today is me, you see. I mean, and that only stands to reason. As time goes on, but the problem is we can't afford it right now. You know, we don't have that many teachers to have, you know, one teacher, unless the students sort of get together and teach themselves and challenge one another. That's true. So I have to be somewhat pragmatic here and say that, well, how can we improve the general situation within the context of the lecture-pupil kind of relationship? And we know, and we still have this problem, you see, in industry, where we're trying to tell the worker on the line what we're really trying to get done in this company, and here are our policies, and don't burn the place down, and we got to keep efficiency. And they have actually used some of these systems, I know at Minneapolis Honeywell, and then run some tests, and they actually did rather show a tremendous increase. They brought some of the lower ones up so that there was some improvement. So I don't see that there's... I hope I've answered your question. You see, this is the situation. Yes, Willie.
I think the problem with communicating, Leo, is that we've got a common vision about how communication takes place. The emphasis usually rests on the ear, and very, very little with the eye. I'm reminded of a segment from the movie Time for Burning. I don't know if all of them, most people have seen it now. Where the barber was holding forth, and later on in the room, Ray Christensen and his wife were talking. Ray Christensen's wife then broke down and started crying. And she said, he talked, hate, hate, hate. And that's all I could hear, hate, hate, hate. And Ray said, well, he talked hate, but his eyes showed love. So there's something to be said for using your eyes to watch the eye. In spite of his seemingly outmoded people, it's a physical minimum possibility for us to even begin to talk about communication without addressing ourselves to one who I think is responsible for another. We're talking now about Marshall McLuhan.
Yeah.
I think he captured a bit of what it's like to move the artist.
Yes. I mentioned this yesterday when we were discussing Turnia here. This is a very important thing to him. He for those of you who are not here, I'll recapitulate this. Because I brought this subject up in the discussion with him, and he said he hardly ever made an appointment by telephone or had discussions by telephone because it was so important for him to have them so he could see them and watch them, especially their eyes. And nonverbal communication, of course, is a very important thing. Ken Erickson will tell you about this, as you well know. It's a very important thing to him. And you know with your wife, Willie, as I know with mine. I mean, she can be clear over there, 50 feet away across a room, you know. She can tell me an awful lot, you know. I mean, she can, boy, just like that, huh? It's like, so it really does work. And this is a very important thing. And I know in an interview, boy, you really got to be watching them.
Can I just say something? Poor pastors have a problem in this business of communication. You tell us who are in academic circles, well, you got it made. They're paid, police, and they're there, they want to learn something. Here we are communicating in church. We've been watching the late movie in 1994, and they come that way into the house of God. Consequently, for generations, we hear this, don't preach to me, dry as a sermon. The preacher, I hate that lousy word. Preaching has a far different connotation. It means proclamation to announce something, the good news. And man alive, for 35 years, I've been trying to get people to get this stuff. I'll do anything. I'll stand on my hands in the pulpit. Although they say pretty good acrobat up there. But a lot of it depends upon the people in the pew, too, the receptivity of them. Remember one 11-year-old boy where I was reading the gospel about the miraculous catch of fish after Easter. And this little kid with myopic eyes, a little wiggle button, and when I said they caught 123 fishes, he said, wow! I said, I'm reading, and I said, that's exactly what it says. And this kid was listening. Believe you me, there was communication.
No, I was, yeah, go ahead.
Just a couple weeks ago, I cleared out a bunch of boxes, and I feel like I threw away about 6 years of my life because these were college notes. And I stopped to think back about that. And I really think in lots of ways we're certainly not taking advantage of the talents of the teachers that use the lecture system. In so many cases, it seems to me that what's presented could just as well be written down, passed out to the students, and then spend the time discussing, or have them read this a day ahead of time, or a week ahead of time, rather than this business of it seems like a medieval practice, you know, we can't print, so you write by hand, we have no printing presses, although I realize the importance of retention, by writing. And I think a lot of this, maybe this is some of the preacher's problem. Why is it that we think that we've got to stand there and we have a certain amount of very stereotyped gestures in often many cases? And again, this business, we learn 15%, I believe it is, through ear and 85% by sight. But how many people use this? Some of the poorest teaching in the world is done by the most educated people.
3 years ago, the Journal of Adult Leadership had a very good article on when a lecture is of any use. And they ended up by saying it's only when the man has new information that hasn't been printed yet.
The way I operate this, for example, on the physiology of the thyroid and the parathyroid, I present the notes to them, the significant part and the structure for the whole thing, and also all of the diagrams that I show to them, by way of explanation where there might be some problems in seeing the whole structure, because there is some benefit in sort of recapitulation. But then I leave places where they might add a new reading that they can put into the structure, and my lecture is pretty much a little bit on explanation, but to point out things that they do not, that isn't yet known to them or readily available to them on this thing, and I think that's right.
I saw somebody with
problem it. Here, though. Now, John Dewey lectured for about 40 years against the lecture method. As far as I know, it's about the only method he ever used was the lecture method. He was tremendously successful in abolishing that method by the method he was condemning. So there must be something effective about it when it's done. The other thing is, we know that if you speed up a lecture, you cut out all unnecessary words, especially if it was taste, that you can communicate a tremendous amount in a much shorter time than with any other method. And then, in addition to that, there is a combination of blackboard technique and lecturing, which is extremely effective, but most places are not geared for that. But this place here isn't geared for that, really. You haven't got the right kind of blackboard, the right kind of setup, and so on. But if that is used, and you can overcome the student's prejudice against approaching him from the viewpoint of the way people really learn, you can get a tremendous batting average. You're the erasure technique that Skinner uses at Harvard. I have to overcome the prejudice of my students. I have to say, if it's a good enough method for the best teacher at Harvard, it may probably meet our standards here, too. Because there's a factor of prejudice that operates on the part of the student. Another point is listening. You're speaking about listening. Listening is a tremendous tool for winning the other person over. The very student who denounces the lecture method, if you can get him in his office and have him lecture to you for about 40 minutes about what he's mad about, and you, at the end of that, recapitulate what he said to you and show that you really understood everything he said, you've won him. You've almost always won him over. Well, then there must be something to the lecture method, at least for the student talking to the teacher.
Doesn't that mean, then, the person who gets the most out of his lecture is the professor?
Not in that case, because in that case, what happens is, by showing the student that you understand him, you've satisfied a tremendous hunger on his part to communicate with someone else. So he ends up getting the most out of it, not the teacher.
But he was the lecturer in that case. Yes, he got the most out of his own.
He was the lecturer, but he got it because you bounced it back. Otherwise, it wouldn't. What he's hungry for is somebody who really listens to him.
Doesn't that mean then that we should have more opportunity for the students to more student feedback to the lecture rather than the sitting, and the proportion of time the students spend listening in college is much greater than it ought to be?
That depends on the subject and the person. If it is an emotional problem, then you should listen to the student. If it's a matter of the communication of information, then it depends on the type of information and so on. In other words, to throw the lecture method out is to fail to realize that there are some points where this is the most effective method, in some places the other is. In other words, you can't just say, we're not going to use this method at all anymore. That's really much too far. And then there's this thing of, we have in the past been training people to learn by reading. They still have to spend most of their time listening. We still don't know how effective we're going to be if we can train people to listen better. Don't throw the method out before we have put about as much time in this as we have on the other approaches. We really haven't spent much time yet. We're just beginning on teaching people how to listen.
Yeah,
any
other? Yes.
I should bring my student
aid.
I missed a lot of information but I think where the real tragedy lies is an interpersonal relationship where you're not listening to someone who needs to have you listen. When I don't listen to you, that's a waste, certainly. But you don't have an emotional need for me to listen to you, whereas maybe my husband or my child does. And that's where the real destructiveness occurs. And, all these techniques for students to listen, that's fine. But I think we need to learn how to listen to each other when we are fearful and hostile and suspicious of the other person. We touched on that when you said there are these emotional words that go flying by and then we're off.
And this is the other dimension that I'm going to get to in just after one more question. I saw Larry's hand up, and then I'm coming back to this.
I spent one first year in terms of communication. I had 5 students in my class, and they're deaf. You have to communicate on your hand, and the real visual point comes in. It's a real difficult stuff.
I'm sure my students aren't deaf, but sometimes I think they are. All right, I'll take one more, and then I want to come back to this.
I was wondering, in personal relations, as far as speaking to the parents, I'm a person who, what do you do for the person, probably that person, who is always the heel doing this argument, or thinking of his next speech, and isn't really listening to what you say, so that you could just go on up in it.
Yeah.
How can you break the deadlock? Each person is giving his own speech, you know, and you walk away, and neither one really that to any other person.
It reminds me of that cartoon. In the morning, it's a big office building, and in the morning, the young psychiatrist is going in, and the old psychiatrist, they find himself in the same elevator. And they have some words as they go up to the 22nd floor. They hadn't seen each other for quite a while. They both get off. At 5 o'clock, they have both happened to have gotten in the same elevator coming back down. And the young psychiatrist, I mean, he's done in, you know, he's completely done in. And very obviously, he's had a bad day. And the old psychiatrist, you know, it's like nothing happened. You know, he looks about the same way as he did in the morning, if not maybe a little better. And the young psychiatrist, he says, boy, what a day. He says, I can't see how you can listen to all these problems all day and still look so fresh. And he says, who listens? Well, and that's our problem. This is the one you're getting to. You're sitting there thinking of some smart answer. Where the thing you should be thinking is trying to help the person. And I recall my 50 years, and a few times I've been able to help somebody. And they've come back and say, you know, you really helped me that time. And I, you know, afterwards, you know, I started thinking, now, when in the world did I help that person? You know, you always think, well, what did I tell that guy to do? You know, you're saying, boy, I must have been something really good. And then you start thinking about it, and you finally suddenly realize you didn't tell him anything. Huh? You listened to him, or you listened to her. Huh? Maybe ask the question. And in this regard, I'll also give you a technique before I forget it. And that's just one of the only exception I can think of to what Willie said as far as the eyes go. And one of the most useful techniques that I have found within my own family, the chief and I, almost every night, we go out for a walk. And you know, when you talk to your wife or husband or your children, you know, in a house, there's usually interruptions, you know. There's the TV is on, you know, and, you know, you're talking to them, you can see them, you know, they're watching a boob tube. Or the radio's on, or there's a newspaper there, and you're listening to your wife, you know, you're checking the headline. You know, it's always this kind of a scene, isn't it? So at night, you know, we go out and if there are problems, and there often are problems, you know, you can discuss them. And we're fortunate, we don't live where there's hardly any street lights. Sometimes the moon is out. We go for quite a long walk. And then, you know, you have pretty much the attention of the other person. And you can really get the thing sort of wrapped up on a night walk. And it's also true of the children. I'd rather not take more than one on a walk. Because, boy, they'll tell you a lot of things they've never told you before. Or for a ride with them. But this is the exception. It's an unusually good technique, I think, for this kind of thing. And to respond to you, I recall for you John Godfrey. He spent most of his life as a mediocre lawyer, and I've told some of you this story before. But he really wanted to be a poet. They were immigrants, and the immigrants thought, boy, you know, to really be somebody, you've got to be a lawyer. They do really rule the nation, but that's another subject. He was a very quiet, dignified sort of a guy, pretty average probably sort of lawyer. He'd done a lot of listening. And unknown to a lot of people, he'd gotten a parcel of land in town, or just out the edge of town, and then town built around him over many, many decades, so that he had a very valuable piece of land, and he invested some of his money. And he really had a pretty pot full of dough. And his wife had died many, many years before. And so he lived alone, and he contracted for a building, a very unusual structure. He got the best architect, and they were really building a terrific building. And of course, many people were very curious about it. They wanted to know, you know, what's this all about? What's that old kook up to? And inlaid in gold over the door were these words: the man who listens. And at the dedication, by way of explanation, he said in his very gentle way, one of the most terrible aspects of this world today is that nobody listens to anyone else. If you are sick or even dying and nobody listens, if you are bewildered or frightened or lost or bereaved or alone or lonely, nobody really listens. Even the clergy are hurried and harassed. They do their best and work endlessly. But time has taken on a fragmented character. It doesn't seem to have any substance any longer. Nobody has time to listen to anyone, not even those who love you and would die for you. Your parents, your children, your friends, they have no time. That's a very terrible thing, isn't it? And it really is. Whose fault is it? I don't know. But there doesn't seem to be any talk. Now these, of course, are the words, for those of you who know it, Taylor Caldwell in her novel, The Listener. But you don't really have to go to the pages of a novel to find out about this. And I'll, sort of in closing, I'll read you a little letter. And this is from real life. Too busy to listen. Dear folks, thank you for everything, but I'm going to Chicago and try to start some kind of new life. You asked me why I did those things and why I gave you so much trouble, and the answer is easy for you to give me, but I'm wondering if you will understand. Remember when I was about 6 or 7 and I used to want you to just listen to me? I remember all the nice things you gave me for Christmas and my birthday, and I was really happy with the things about a week. That is at the time I got the things, but the rest of the time during the year I really didn't want presents. I just wanted all the time for you to listen to me like I was somebody who felt things too. Because I remembered, even when I was young, I felt things. But you said you were too busy. Mom, you're a wonderful cook. And you had everything so clean, and you were tired so much from doing all those things that made you busy. But you know something, Mom? I would have liked crackers and peanut butter just as well if you'd only sat down with me for a little while during the day and said to me, tell me all about it so that I can maybe help you understand. And when Donna came, I couldn't understand why everyone made so much fuss, because I didn't think it was my fault that her hair is so curly and her skin so white. She doesn't have to wear glasses with such thick lenses. Her grades were better too, weren't they? Donna ever has any children, I hope you will tell her just to pay some attention to the one who doesn't smile very much, because that one will really be crying inside. And when she's about to bake 6 dozen cookies, to make sure first that the kids don't want to tell her about a dream or a hope or something, because thoughts are important too to small kids, even though they don't have so many words to use when they tell about what they have inside of them. I think that all the kids who are doing so many things that grown-ups are tearing out their hair worrying about are really looking for somebody that will have time to listen a few minutes and who really and truly will treat them as they would a grown-up who might be useful to them, you know, polite to them. If you folks had ever said to me, pardon me, when you interrupted me, I'd have dropped dead. If anybody asks you where I am, tell them that I've gone looking for somebody with time, because I've got a lot of things I want to talk about. This is from Creative Brooding by Robert A. Raymond, and it's from Real Life. And that's where I close.